Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I reiterate, that is Audrey, and we could not do it without her. One more time, she gets us connected to the internet so that we can broadcast to millions worldwide. Well, maybe not that many. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that little trip across the country, 90 cities and states. I wonder if Johnny has noticed on his own, traveling like that. The big study came out, psychologists this week, they studied and studied and studied, and they found out that life in big cities is more stressful than living in the country. I'm waiting for people to get back up and sit in their chair. They probably fell off their chair when they heard that. I wonder how much that one cost us as taxpayers to find that out. Emily and Mike, thank you for joining us too. But can you imagine that? I guess we always knew that, but now we can prove it one more time, that life in the country may be more pleasant than life in the city. What we're trying to do here is discuss news issues and events and developments in this difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Our show is dedicated to those police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world. And I suppose we ought to pay tribute. We don't do that enough to our military, who are fighting how many countries now, Mike? I guess when you join the Army now, you could maybe have you spin a roulette wheel and you can pick your country. But I think it's four right now, and we're probably doing something in Pakistan too. So who knows? Someone can explain all that to me later, why we're doing all that, but there must be a reason. What we tried to do is look inside the criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals. Tonight, we're not looking exactly at criminal justice, but we're looking at a topic that relates to everyone that's on the internet, just about. And although I know a few people who've retracted from Google, but anyway, the subject tonight has to do with the way we learn, the way we study, the way we read, and also our privacy. And I think you're really going to enjoy listening to this gentleman present his book called The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry a Little Bit About All That. But you're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network. What a deal. Alvin Levy discovered this 4.5 years ago, something like that. We're over that now, I guess. And anybody that wants to can get a radio show, and it says right there on the website, you can get signed up and 15 minutes or something like that and have your own show and broadcast worldwide or around the corner. If that's all the farther you want to go, because people can listen to you on the internet. These shows are archived immediately for MP3 download. And you go to podcastdirectory.com and you can see any of these people's shows. I saw Ann Coulter. She's one of the feature shows that they're advertising on there. She has a show, a conservative commentator. But Barack Obama has used Blog Talk Radio and on and on and on. Tonight's show, I told you what we're going to do. We're going to look at some news before we listen to this gentleman talk about his book, The Googleization of Everything. And it's interesting, and it relates to some other things that are going on right now in terms of use and overuse of technological equipment. I've commented on that before. I have more to say. If you choose to call in during the news segment of the show, we've got some little crazy news items, not directly related to criminal justice always, but crazy. We can listen to you. You just call in on 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. Audrey has a blonde joke for tonight. It's a little difficult for us to find this one, Audrey, but I think we can do it. A little technological issue here. Go ahead, Audrey.
Tonight we are going to break precedent. Instead of having one blonde joke, we are going to have three shorter ones. I picked one. Emily selected another. Mike selected the third one. Here they are. We hope our listeners enjoy them. Question: if a blonde and a brunette fell off a building, who would hit the ground first? Answer: the brunette. The blonde would have to stop for directions. Joke number two. The assistant asked the blonde if she would like her pizza cut into 6 pieces or 12. 6, please, she said. I could never eat 12. And finally, joke number 3. A blonde was walking down the road with a healthy-looking pig under her arm. As she passed the bus stop, someone asked, "Where did you get that?" The pig replied, "I won her in a raffle." Professor Haley, tonight we are going to break precedent. Instead of having one blonde joke, we are going to have three shorter ones. I picked one. Emily selected another. Mike selected the third one. Here they are. We hope our listeners enjoy them. Question: if a blonde and a brunette fell off a building, who would hit the ground first? Answer: the brunette. The blonde would have to stop.
I won't explain how that one happened. Okay, very good, very good, very good. We can still applaud. This new switchboard we're switching to. We can still applaud, Audrey. Okay, thank you. I apologize for that. That is something. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note and even more important tonight, as the economy gets bad, some people are actually going out and committing crime. We want to fight the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms and their public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we always hope that that message falls in the right ears. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to give our green tip for tonight. And have you thought about that? When you're out walking your dog, keep your dog on a leash. I saw folks today with their dog off the leash. If you're walking your dog in an area that contains wildlife, keep it under control or on a leash. Dogs can disturb ground nesting birds to the point of abandoning their nests. The same applies on beaches where they can disturb the seashore animals. So remember, keep your dog on a leash. And I know lots of people don't like to do that, but that's Esma Floyd's little tip number 995 in her book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Thank you very much. Well, let's take a look at some of this news. And I think some of it borders on crazy. Could we actually say that, Emily? Emily, I know you like this first one. It's one of your favorite subjects. The food police are going to now launch a staggering crackdown on various foods that are marketed to children. Tony the Tiger, some NASCAR drivers, and cookie-selling Girl Scouts will be out of a job unless grocery manufacturers agree to reinvent a vast array of their products to satisfy the Obama administration's food police. Either retool the recipes to contain certain levels of sugar, sodium, and fats, or no more advertising and marketing to tots and teenagers, says federal regulatory agencies. Not just one. There's more than one. The same goes for restaurants. I mean, it's just not the usual suspected foods that we're talking about here. They're talking about such as Thin Mint cookies, M&M's, and Snickers. Snickers, by the way, sponsors race cars. I never knew that. But anyway, they sponsor cars in the Sprint Cup, whatever that is. But pretty much everything on a restaurant menu. Well, then the intent of the guidelines is to combat childhood obesity. Foods that are low in calories, fat, and some considered healthy foods are also targets, including hot breakfast cereals such as oatmeal, pretzels, popcorn, nuts, yogurt, wheat bread, bagels, diet drinks, fruit juice, tea, bottled water, milk, and sherbet. I guess that leaves carrots and celery. But the food industry is in an uproar over this proposed written set of agreements by the Federal Trade Commission, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The quad team there is going to jump on this particular kind of food. But isn't it just incredible, ladies and gentlemen, that, and you know, Mayor Bloomberg, nobody's better than this Bloomberg. He's the one that made all the restaurants in New York City put up their calories on their menus, and I think it was a year or two later that people actually ate more. Hey, that looks good. That's 100 calories extra. I think I'll get that one. But we are going to be doing this, and now they're just strongly suggesting this, that the food industry people said, look, when they say strongly suggest and you don't do it, and they said it, then we're going to make it regulation that they're actually going to do that. Now, don't we need to send some of these people away on vacation or something? I mean, what in the world are they doing telling us what to eat and how to advertise products? The most heavily marketed directly to children and adolescents fall into 10 categories: breakfast cereals, snack foods, candy, dairy products, baked goods, carbonated beverages, fruit juice, and non-carbonated beverages, prepared foods, meals, frozen and chilled desserts, and restaurant foods. And they're not going to stop. They are simply not going to stop. And they're saying that this is part of WIC. This is the nutrition program for women, infants, and children. I guess maybe men can get as fat as they want. Well, they're not mentioned in here directly, but is there a point where we just can't take this anymore? I mean, why in the world are they doing that? Well, anyway, let's shift to a criminal justice, clearly a criminal justice topic, although that's related. Ohio is going to go into this great, innovative chapter of their criminal justice and prison history. They've passed a bill called a Smart on Crime Bill, a sweeping overhaul of Ohio's criminal justice sentencing laws, criminal sentencing laws. They passed the Senate yesterday. This is dated, in fact, that was yesterday, June 22nd, with strong bipartisan support. With the state prison system bursting at the seams, the state leaders finding it ever tougher to afford housing. About 51,000 inmates. It was built for 38,000. Guess what they're going to do? They're going to give inmates the chance to not go to prison and allow them to reduce their sentences through education, job training, and drug treatment. And they know what they're going to do? They're going to separate out the nonviolent offenders from the violent offenders. The violent offenders will get prison. The nonviolent will get to go to a high school course on you know, how to work your iPod or iPad or something like that. But anyway, does this sound like the 1960s and 70s? I think we've done this before. But they are going to separate the violent from the nonviolent. You know what the nonviolent criminal is. That's the one that you haven't caught in your house yet when they were burglarizing it. But if you come home early, guess what? And by the way, do you think that these felons and these violent felons, those are the only crimes? I mean, if I'm an armed robber, do you think I might steal once in a while too? I'll bet. That's what the research is, and criminal justice helped all these sociologists and criminologists and psychiatrists figure that out. And here we go again, and we've got study after study now that shows that when you let an inmate out of prison, it is much more expensive to let them run than to leave them in a prison cell. They say it's 4 to 5 times more expensive, because guess what they continue to do? Commit crimes. Most people in prison have been there before. So isn't that going to be interesting that we're going to do something like this? We have lived this in the 1960s and 70s. We got wise about the late 1980s and 90s, began to lock up the criminals. The crime rates plummeted to what they are now, the lowest we've had in 50 years for the last 3 years. But House Bill 86 is going to start turning them loose, so I think now might be a good time to go get your concealed carry license, or at least a firearm or a bow and arrow or something for the House, because they're going to be turning them loose probably at a unprecedented rate. I just don't understand it. Speaking of Google, that's our topic for tonight. Google just hit $1 billion, or 1 billion hits, unique 1 billion visitors, excuse me, for the month of May. The first time any internet company has ever done that. Microsoft is number two. They're getting about 905 million, I guess, with their Bing and some other things, and Facebook surged by 30% to 714 million visitors. Yahoo's 689. But they keep scoring. That's just an outfit called ComScores. It estimates, its estimates are based on its global measurement panel of 2 million internet users, but Google tops the list. And related to that, guess what? India is no longer allowing Google to use its street cam. Remember the Street View cam that in Canada, the United States, France, Germany, and Spain had accidentally collected thousands and thousands of people's emails? Well, India is not going to allow that, but their reason is that when you put all of our streets, buildings, et cetera, on street cam, then terrorists will be able to figure out good places to go, and it will actually be helping them. So that's kind of an interesting idea. I'm going to save this one about drones. There's a long article in the New York Times about drones, and this just came out here a couple of days ago, and it's about thank you for paying your taxes, and the manufacturers of these drones really like this idea. We're going to be using more and more drones, and some of them are actually going to be flapping wings, little drones. In other words, they will be as small as a mosquito, and they could be sitting on your window ledge, your windowsill, and looking into your house. And they anticipate that for all kinds of operations, and the imagination will be the only restraint, that these little flying drones the size of a mosquito or a little bit larger can in fact land on your windowsill and other places and be taking surveillance pictures and audio monitoring probably also. So won't that be fun? Get yourself a fly swatter or some bug spray, that'll freeze it up. But and you know they're going to make more and more of these things. I mean, if it's possible, we're going to do it. When somebody say in America, if something's worth doing, it's worth overdoing, and I'll bet we're going to be doing it on this particular thing right here. Well, I think what I'm going to do is go right over to our discussion of the Googleization of everything. And I think if you haven't thought about this, you're probably going to enjoy this. And this fits in with the larger thing about all the use of technology and Facebook and all that stuff. And every day I hear more stories about why people are on Facebook. They must be crazy. The false stuff that's put up there about them just because they originally started on there. But anyway, I could go on. There's a story about a university president just arrested for prostitution, helping to run a prostitution ring. Can you believe that? He's president of the University of New Mexico for 2 years, but it had to do with 4 or 5 step process. These people, another professor he worked with, and they use Facebook and other kinds of things and a website. I would stay off of Facebook. And everybody that's going to be a police applicant, police departments are telling them that. Because you can't change anything up there, I guess. If something's up there, it's false. I mean, you can't do anything anything about it. So here we go. We're going to give it a try. And I hope this works, because I think you're going to enjoy this. This is Siva Vaid Hayan Than, I think, media studies and law professor at the University of Virginia. And what he contends is that Google's ever-growing prominence as the sole search engine for many Internet users allows the company to decide what is of the greatest interest and value on the web. And this presents a singular view of what is available to the user. The author argues for changes in the ways that people sort and receive their information online in hopes of moving away from what he considers the blind faith that we grant to Google. A very interesting idea. He made this presentation at the Harvard Bookstore, and we're working off of booktv.org one more time. But it's a very interesting thing, and here we go with it, and I hope this works, so bear with us here just a moment.
And now, Siva Vaidyanathan contends that because Google is the sole search engine for many Internet users, the company is able to control what is of greatest interest and value on the web, presenting a singular view of what's available to the user. The author argues for changes in the ways that people sort and receive information online. Mr. Vaidyanathan presents his arguments at the Harvard University Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for a little over an hour.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be here, and thank you for braving the rain and joining me today. So Google is 12 years old. Its voice hasn't even changed yet. It's barely an adolescent, and yet it's been an important part of so many daily activities for so many of us. One of the major reasons I wrote this book is it struck me as weird, historically weird, technically weird, sociologically weird, that one company would serve as the lens through which we view the world in so many ways, so many times a day. I'm not sure, at least I wasn't sure at the beginning, that we should complain about this situation. After all, we invited it, we celebrate it, we relish it, and we do it, right? We Google all the time. And so I tried to enter this project with that sense of weirdness, first and foremost. I wanted to constantly remind myself and remind my readers that this was not the natural state of things. Things could have gone very differently. So go back to when Google was a newborn. You probably had not even heard of it in its first year, 1998. When it first rolled out for public use, it was actually hosted by the Stanford University servers. You found it at google.stanford.edu. The first few notices that I was able to find in the popular press referred to it at that URL. And even early on, it was clear that Google was going to be the darling of people who were excited about technology, technologically sophisticated. It accomplished a couple of things that had been eluding a lot of other companies that had been trying to organize the web and help navigate. First and foremost, it had a blank page, right, with just a box through which you would enter text and generate a fairly clean selection of links. And the links would be in order, and the order seemed to make sense to us, right? It struck us as intuitively right, intuitively relevant. And the great leap that Google made early on was, first of all, to use that blank page. And at a time when, if you remember the web in the late 90s, and some of you might, the web was crazy. It was full of all kinds of flashing things and crazy things, and every page looked like, you know, walking down Times Square in the middle of the night. It was just a lot of attention-grabbing devices on too many web pages. In addition, the major search engine services of the day Alta Vista, or Yahoo, which is still with us and actually not going anywhere for a while, those services tended to crowd their pages with content. Some of that content they would actually pay to create. Others they would pay to harvest from other places. There was no sense that these other portals to the web understood the web the way that Google did, right? The folks who started Google understood, first of all, that you and I are perfectly willing to create content that Google can then harvest and link to and share with us. And they don't have to pay us, right? That was an amazing insight. The other insight about that blank page was the blank page was trustworthy. The blank page said, I'm not trying to sell you anything, and I'm not trying to take you anywhere you don't want to go. And at a time when it was clear that many search engines were actually auctioning off the position of their search results, Google made it very clear, largely through word of mouth, and thus through the press ultimately, that its search engine results were generated by their algorithms purely. And their algorithms were at a distance from the immediate interest of the company. In fact, the company had no interest, as you can imagine. Until about 2003, the company wasn't even selling advertising. Right? It was just running on venture capital money, and it hadn't even figured out a model for selling advertising well until about 2003. So for the first 4 or 5 years of Google's existence, it was there to be great, and it worked. So in 1998, it debuted. Right? By the time Google was 1 year old, it's just starting to walk, it was already organizing the web for us. It was already making it clear to millions of web users that the web didn't have to be a chaotic place, that one could use it to draw a usable map for information, to get from one place to another. Well, before search engines were good, before Google really reinvented the search engine, one had to find a good starting page and follow a series of good links to other pages, right, and collect that trail and sometimes try to guide other people through that trail to replicate the same information. And it was maddening, and it was chaotic, and you didn't know if you were missing some good stuff. But most of the time, you didn't even find good stuff. You found a lot of scary stuff or weird stuff or inappropriate stuff, and there just was no method to the madness of the web. So Google almost immediately sets itself up, almost inadvertently, as the custodian of the web. Now, over time, Google did something else very clever. Google had to figure out what puts one link above another. Why should one page be more important than another? And the term that Google uses for the criteria upon which it would rank these links is relevance. Which page is more relevant to the search than another page? So there are a lot of different ways to do this. In the early days of web search, the number of times a search term showed up on a page counted for a lot, right? Because if there were a page about the Boston Red Sox, it might say Red Sox a lot on that page, and that's a pretty good guess, you would think, for the importance of that page to that search. Problem is, it didn't take long before people figured that out, and they would make a page about something completely different and just load it up with invisible text for common search terms, right? Terms that people were using all the time anyway, and that would trick people into going to these unrelated pages. You can imagine that pornographers will master this at very early. And the fact that pornographers, people who put up pornography pages in the early days of the web, were generally so much smarter than anybody doing anything else on the web, largely because it was the only kind of business making money on the web at the time, the big trick for Google, as it became the custodian of the web, was to figure out how to make the web less offensive, less threatening, more usable, more pleasant. And if it can do that, Google figured, eventually, I'm using Google as if Google is an actual person or animal, which actually my 5-year-old daughter sort of says sometimes. She thinks Google is a person. When she talks about my book, she imagines that I've actually met this person named Google, and I go to California to meet this person named Google, and apparently Google invited me to a party one time. I don't know. There's some story she tells her friends. But imagine this, right? You've got the web, which in the late 90s and early part of the aughts was a scary place, and many reasonable people were not sure how much interaction they wanted to have with the web. These were days when it was hard to convince someone that doing something like banking was a good idea on the web, and that's probably the end of the list, right? Shopping was risky. Research was risky. Putting your kids down in front of the computer without someone looking over his or her shoulder was risky, right? That sort of activity, it was important for everyone who wanted to make money on the web to make the web a less frightening place. And we didn't even notice this was going on. But so Google had installed some more criteria. Instead of using this sort of number of times search terms appear in the page, Google decided that there's a vote of affirmation out there, and it's called the hyperlink. If there are people creating web pages around the world, and they happen to be interested in the Boston Red Sox, and they start creating web links to what they consider an authoritative page about information concerning the Boston Red Sox, it may actually be the team's official page, it may be some fan page where a person has tremendous insight, it may be ESPN's page, but they're going to start creating links saying, you want to find out what's going on with the Red Sox, these are the pages to look towards. They don't spell out those words, but by creating hyperlinks, it was interpreted as a vote of affirmation. So the great insight of Google's engineers, in fact, Google's founders figured this out and wrote a paper when they were in graduate school, that basically made it so that a page's relevance would be scored by the number of votes it gets from around the Internet. And then they weighted that because they knew that if, for instance, ESPN starts pointing to somebody's homemade page about the Red Sox, that's a really powerful vote of affirmation, right? Or if in some other area, the Wall Street Journal webpage links to somebody's financial advice blog, there weren't actually blogs at the time, but you can imagine that counts for a lot. It's a major sense of affirmation within that field. And so those votes are weighted more than if I put up a link to somebody's page on my blog, right? So that was major insight number one. Major insight number two was that you can start scoring the results based on the quality of the page. And this happens a little bit later in Google's history. It actually happens in the last couple of years. Google starts saying there are certain design elements of a page that work better for us and we think work better for our users, our readers. And those are often expressed graphically and not just textually. Right? So it's not hard to imagine that pages that are trying to trick you into falling into the pornography world are going to be full of lots of extra video, links that go into strange places, lots of extraneous code, what they call malware, you know, little programs that embed themselves in your browser and ultimately your operating system and potentially corrupt your computer. Like, the bad people in the world are going to load up their pages with lots of nasty stuff, and Google has an interest, again, in making the web usable, trustworthy, and pleasant. So Google starts downgrading the scores of pages that are designed in such a way and upgrading the score of pages that are designed cleanly, that have keywords in them that relate honestly to the subject of the page, and, of course, have these votes of affirmation. So within a very short period of time, the web becomes a trustworthy place. And lo and behold, this in combination with the widespread use of encryption, for instance, you get people actually shopping and actually banking on the web. And the more time people spend on the open web, ultimately the better it is for Google, because Google is a starting point. Instead of having to follow links, you go back to the central place, and it gives you a menu of places to dive into. You're no longer actually using it in a webby way. You're plumbing for depth when you do a subject search on Google. So that's the nice story. But again, Google's 12 years old. It's an adolescent. Its voice is just starting to change. By 2004, when Google was merely six, it started remarkably expanding its areas of interest. And about that time, I started really taking notes. I had used Google from 99, from the time I first heard from some very tech-savvy friends that this was a search engine to trust. But around 2004, Google started launching a number of other projects, and we're all familiar with what those projects became, projects like Google News, projects like Gmail, and the Google Books project, through which it would scan in millions of books from dozens of libraries around the world, ultimately. It started with five, including this university, and then moved on to many others. And this project kind of blew my mind, right? So in 2004, I start reading about this project to scan in millions of books, and I start seeing this amazing hyperbole coming from people who are working for universities and university libraries, from people who are big fans of Google, and from people who just want knowledge to spread. And they start saying, what an amazing thing that this big, powerful company is going to spread knowledge to every corner of the world pretty much for free. And I start reading things in all sorts of corners, basically saying this is going to unleash information in a remarkable way, create a new library of Alexandria that anyone can go into. And I'm sitting back there saying, You know Google's 6 years old, right? I mean, Google at that point was around for less time than Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston had been married, right? And look how well that turned out. So I said, why is a university like the University of Michigan or Harvard University or Stanford University asking a six-year-old company to be the custodian of this immense amount of wealth and knowledge? This can't end well, is basically what I thought. It might start beautiful, but it can't end well. Right? This was obviously a controversial project when it came to copyright, right? The publishers and authors whose work was being scanned in without permission raised all sorts of issues and eventually lawsuits, and the lawsuits were settled in a way that made it very clear several years down the line that Google never really intended to make a library. It intended to make a bookstore. And I love bookstores. I'm in a bookstore. Bookstores are great. There's nothing wrong with the bookstore, but I'm not too pleased with a bookstore that tries to pretend it's a library. So from about 2004, I started seeing that Google's real corporate mission statement, which is, believe it or not, to organize the world's information to make it universally accessible, is actually kind of scary. Now, I was born in the 20th century. I lived for about, 40% of the 20th century. And I know enough about the 20th century to know that when somebody makes a big grand statement like that, you need to step back and beware, right? Because 20th century involves a lot of big grand statements that didn't turn out so well either. Not that anything close to chaos and nastiness and horrible tragedy was likely to come from anything Google was doing. But nonetheless, I thought, what an odd thing. What a strange way to run a company, to say that the goal of the company is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. I knew enough about the web, right? My job is actually to kind of study the web, right? So I knew enough about the web to know that they're organizing the web. They're not organizing the world's information, and the web is not the world. It wasn't then. It isn't now, right? Because what's valuable or important or relevant on the web is a refraction of what's real in the world. And you can do this by doing a basic Google search for a subject you know a lot about. You will see pages that you might not think of as the most authoritative, but they are the most relevant and, according to the standards Google brings to the table, the best design pages with the most links to them. But the web is merely an abstraction of the sort of thought that many people on this earth actually engage in every day. But think of the number of people who don't engage with the web yet. Think of the ways we engage with each other and with information that doesn't actually get accurately reflected on that. It's really important to remember that Google itself has value judgments and biases built into its algorithms that distill their results in a particular way. And there's nothing wrong with that. It actually is so much better than the absence of that. It's so much better than what anybody else has thought of. But it's not the world, and it's not the world's information. And I'm enough of a pragmatist and enough of a pluralist to think no one institution and no one company should actually have that job of organizing the world's information and making it universally accessible. The mission statement of Harvard University isn't that audacious, right? You can imagine Harvard not being audacious, right? In that case, I mean, I'm sure the mission of Harvard University actually reads something like to educate the young men of New England to be clergy or something, because that's what it originally was meant to do. But really, that's a stunning mission statement. Now, we're probably all more familiar with its informal model, the company's informal model, which is don't be evil. And I started thinking what that means. Because every time Google does something that causes friction in the world, it sends its cars through the streets of Europe, taking pictures of people without their permission. And in Europe, people are pretty sensitive about anybody taking a picture without permission and putting it in a searchable database. They've had some bad experiences with databases. They didn't call them databases in the 30s and 40s, but they had some bad experiences. People keeping too much information about people in centralized places and then using it to pull people out of their neighborhoods and houses and sending them off on trains. So, there's a little bit of sensitivity in Europe about privacy and about personal information. We don't necessarily have that kind of level of concern here in this country. We're a lot more trustworthy, if nothing else, the private sector and major corporations. Right, but there's been a lot of conflict in Europe, a lot of tension in Europe, a lot of stress and friction over these sorts of things. In the United States, of course, we've had a lot of friction and controversy about YouTube, about things that show up on YouTube, and a lot of friction and controversy about the Google Book Program. Right? And understanding that every time that Google is confronted with a situation in which somebody is upset and somebody calls for some sort of intervention or regulation, Google's basic defense is, trust us. We treat you well. We've always treated you well. we have this internal ethic, this internal motto of don't be evil. They actually don't say those words out loud. Like the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, who's about to step down, to my knowledge, has never stood up in front of an audience and said, we believe the motto, don't be evil. I've never heard him say that. But it's embedded in many things he does say, and many other major officials at Google say things that sound like a declaration of corporate socialism. So I started asking that question. Why do we fall for that every time, first of all? Secondly, why do we think that a company that is basically 12 years old is going to be anything like it currently is in the next 20 years? Why would we think that future performance is in any way predicted by past performance? Because it is, of course, conditions change, right? Companies change, economies change, politics change. And we do know that in the world of new media or the world of digital communication or the markets dealing with the Internet, that nobody's king for very long. When Google started, everyone was concerned that Microsoft would be calling all the shots in our information. I thought that. I thought that was true. Right? Things shifted over time. Now Google is the one we worry about. Now we're starting to worry about Facebook. And, in fact, Google's worried about Facebook for some very legitimate reasons in terms of competition for advertising dollars and our attention. So as I started stringing together these concerns, I thought it's really important that I come up with a way to sort of distill what Google means to us and what we mean to Google. Other really great writers had gotten inside of Google, had traveled on the plane with the big guys who run Google, had told the story of the company, had written the biography of the company, and other people had written lots of books about how we can all learn from Google or other companies can learn from Google and make a lot of money. I couldn't write books like that, and other good writers had already done that, right? My contribution, I hoped, as I started this, was to delve into our relationship with Google. What does Google mean to us, and what do we mean to Google? What is the nature of the transaction? Why does Google do all this? Right? Why do they spend so many billions of dollars on services that help me make my life better, and they don't ask for any money for them? What's going on there? I mean, we should be a little suspicious. So what is the nature of the transaction? What am I giving Google? The obvious answer, once you think about it for 5 minutes, is I'm not actually Google's customer, neither are you. Right? I'm Comcast's customer, so I get mad at Comcast all the time, right? Something doesn't work or my bill's too high, I get mad at Comcast because I'm writing a check to it. I know I'm Comcast's customer. But I'm not Google's customer. I'm Google's product. I am what Google sells to advertisers. That's nothing new, right? I'm NBC's product every Sunday when I watch the NFL, right? NBC selling my attention to beer companies and car companies. So it's not a new model, but I think we forget it because of the depth of interaction and immersion in Google. We consider Google to be a part of our lives, embedded in our lives. Google keeps very good track of our intentions and our desires and our fetishes and obsessions and focuses the results of our searches to reflect what we've already told Google we really, really like thinking about. Now, that has some interesting implications. And Google is changing, right? So I described earlier the ways that Google mastered the web, figured out a great, efficient, and effective way to help us navigate the web, right? Some brilliant ideas about counting these links, weighting these links properly. So in recent years, in the last few years, Google's added yet another layer of standards or criteria. And what they're really focusing on now is what they call the user experience. They want our experience with Google to be really satisfying, deeply satisfying, and more fun than it has been before. More satisfying in a social way, more satisfying in an intellectual way, more satisfying, and most important, in a commercial way. So they're taking the record of our expressions and desires that we enter in the little box, right? It's the confessional. We just what we really wanted, what we really did, or what we shouldn't have done, and we're thinking about, and we probably shouldn't be thinking about. We put all that in the Google box. We get results. Google makes a note. It doesn't necessarily associate that text you put into the box with you as a person. It doesn't care about your name. It doesn't care about your social security number. But it cares about where you're sitting when you're doing that. So it knows generally in the world where you are, and it can associate your your set of inquiries with others who sit in the same general area. It might also, over time, if you happen to have an account with Google, like a Gmail account, build up a pretty rich set of indicators of the sorts of cars you like, the sorts of shoes you like, the sorts of books you like. Kind of like how Facebook does it, just because we tell Facebook all this stuff, right? Foolishly, hey, Facebook, I like this music. And of course, Facebook's job is to take all that data and associate ads in the column to try to sell us stuff. Well, Google's trying to do the same sort of thing with the record of intentions that we give to. And again, it's not anything that's easily exploitable, as far as we know. It's not easily attachable to our name and social security number and address, as far as we know. It does know our location in many cases, especially if you have a Google phone, an Android phone. Google knows where you are almost all the time. GPS chip, or Apple knows where you are if you have an iPhone. So with all of this data, Google is increasingly focusing the results on you, customizing the results, and localizing them. So you're not likely to come up with a result that is distant from you, or is sort of out of character, or out of place, or out of the field to which you usually explore. That has some pretty amazing implications. First of all, that's really great. Think of the time they're saving, right? I think a lot about a particular sports team, or I think a lot about a particular kind of car. Maybe I have a car that breaks down a lot, and I do a lot of searches for parts and repairs. Well, Google's going to help me save time, so I'm not clicking too much. It's going to keep giving me results that reflect those sorts of areas, right? Because Google eventually will understand I do a lot of searches for that brand of car. That's really great for shopping, for buying. Not so great for learning. We want an information ecosystem that actually serves us well as curious people, as citizens, as people who are trying to navigate the world and make sense of the world, as people who are trying to figure out what these symptoms mean, as people who are trying to figure out what's going on with climate change, as people are trying to figure out what's going on with healthcare reform, we might actually be better off not having focused information. We might be better off coming across a set of results that surprise us or challenge us, a set of results that don't reinforce where we already were and where we already are. We might be better off coming up with a set of results that aren't particularly geared toward consumption. And we're better off coming up with a set of results that aren't a mixture of ways to help us consume and ways to help us learn. Now, for a dozen years, we've gotten very lucky. Google has served both of these interests remarkably well. Think of all the times Google has helped you answer a really important question. And, of course, if you're in any way doubtful or critical of Google, you probably went to a second source. You might have called a librarian. You might have called someone who's written a book on the subject. You might have called a doctor instead of just going to WebMD through Google, right? You might have clicked on the second page of results. You might have run the same search on another search engine. All of these are very healthy techniques. And another reason I wrote this book is I wanted people to learn how to use Google in a better way. I use Google every day, dozens of times a day. I use Google to find my way to this door, right? I'm not in any way going to advocate that we not use Google. But I am going to advocate that we use Google in a wiser way. Not just a smarter way, a wiser way. I want us to all understand that Google has biases and limitations baked into its algorithms, that Google is a company, it's a publicly traded company, that must satisfy the desires of its shareholders to enhance value. That is its job number one. And it's been so good at that, it's been so wealthy, that it can afford to be good. And so it has, for the most part. And even when it's bad, it thinks it's being good. It's part of the problem. But with all that, we could be better, right? The real problem is with us. The real problem is we are so addicted to the speed and convenience of that lovely set of results that comes in a nice set of 10 with a value attached to each. And we trust it. We trust it so much that almost nobody clicks past result number 3 on the first page of results, let alone clicks to the second page. That's absurd, right? Nobody clicks to the second page. And in fact, next time you do a Google search, please click to the second page. Just see. You never know, right? But we've seen study after study, academic studies and industry studies show that people do not even question the judgment that Google makes. People do not question the judgment to the point of clicking on results 4, 5, or 6. It's 1, 2, or 3. And actually, if a lot of people start clicking on 2, it soon becomes number 1. So with all that, I think it's incumbent upon us to mix it up a little bit, right? To bring a little bit of diversity into our information ecosystem. To make sure that while we want Google to keep getting better and keep serving us so well, you know, in a way that all we're really giving it is this list of our desires. And that's not that bad a price to pay considering the value it's brought to our lives. But let's do it in a more intelligent way, in a wiser way. Let's understand what the real risks and costs are. Let's understand that we actually have the power to manipulate what Google learns about us and how it follows us. You can actually do that. It takes about 7 clicks. Most people don't want to make those 7 clicks, right? We don't even want to do it on Facebook when it's clear we should be doing it. But on Google, you really can customize what information you give Google to a large degree. There's a cost to that, and that's another important thing we need to learn about Google. If you customize the way Google tracks you and limit the amount of information and the kinds of information Google follows about you, you degrade the service that Google gives you. And it's a real obvious trade-off once you start clicking on those. You start seeing that Google no longer helps you shop as well, but it might actually help you learn a little better and challenge you a little bit. So as Google becomes better for shopping and worse for learning, that raises, I think, a really important question for us as citizens of the country and citizens of the world. Because I happen to think there's more to life than shopping, although not today. Please shop. It's important. Shop here and shop a lot. But after you get out of here, maybe you don't have to shop quite as much. But when you think about the extent to which we depend on this medium of the World Wide Web to learn about the world, maybe we need to imagine differences. Maybe we need to invest more in systems like public libraries and university libraries and their outreaches to other communities. Maybe we have to imagine that we can build a system, and it might take 50 years, build a system that can equalize the maldistribution of information across the world to the point where, and I don't think this is impossible, that a child growing up in South Africa has no disadvantage compared to a child growing up in Sweden when it comes to access to information. We have the tools to make that happen right now. We might have the political will to make it happen right now. We haven't even tested it. The reason we haven't tested it is that Google's been too good to us, right? We've been going on believing that cotton candy is real food. And Google keeps feeding us great services that simulate this equality of information, this democratization of information. And Google, of course, is sincere that it would like the number of web users in the world to increase exponentially. Google would love, as much as I would love, for every 12-year-old growing up in South Africa to have access to amazing information. And it's pouring money into such projects, and that's beautiful. But we should not rely on this 12-year-old company to guide that effort, because over time there are going to be hard choices to make in terms of policy, hard choices to make in terms of technology, hard choices to make in terms of practice. So as a citizen, I think it's imperative that we start asking questions about whether we want Google to handle all of our shopping and all of our learning needs. And if we don't, and if we recognize that Google in 20 years is almost certain to be a very different company, maybe even owned at that time by somebody completely different, like the reincarnated head of Rupert Murdoch or something, right? Who knows what's going to happen down the line. But at that point, Google won't be the Google that we grew up with, right? The mature Google is going to have different pressures. It's going to have different – who's going to know what the World Wide Web is in 20 years? We didn't know what it was 20 years ago, right? And as we move more of our information-seeking habits and shopping-seeking habits to lock down closed devices that aren't really on the web but are connected through digital networks nonetheless, and the more time we spend in the gated community of Facebook as opposed to the open web, the less money Google's going to make in the long term, unless it can keep expanding its market. So this is an interesting battle going on that we should be paying a lot of attention to. Right? Google wants people to be comfortable with the web, as I said at the beginning, and is doing everything it can to keep the internet open and free because that's good for Google. Not just because it's good for us. It happens to be good for us, which is nice. But over time, not everything that's good for Google will be good for us. We have to be prepared for that divergence. And at those moments, we're going to have to ask, are there things that we want to preserve and extend and build that Google should not do for us or could not do for us? And under those conditions, we might want to decide to take some other route. Crazy as it may seem, the route we might want to take is the old-fashioned public library. We might want to invest more in its presence, in its power, in its expansion, because that is a reasonable, citizen-driven, good old-fashioned Republican with a small R institution. And it's there to help us as citizens. And it's there to help us as information seekers, as learners, as students, as teachers. And we take it for granted because it works so well, and we make this sort of false conclusion that Google sends information to us so efficiently that we need the public library less. But in fact, Americans these days use the public library more than ever. Americans these days are visiting public libraries in record numbers. The Americans who happen to be visiting libraries in record numbers don't subscribe to broadband access at home. In fact, they can't actually write a check for content to broadband access. That's what we have to remember. If our goal as citizens should be for maximum empowerment of all citizens. Our goal as consumers should be to get the best price. And again, that's such a different way of being in the world, and I think it's time we start taking both roles seriously instead of just. Thank you very much, and I'd love to have questions.
I'm well away off my feet of what a pro-Google presentation is.
Yes.
And the only thing that we should worry is that Google isn't doing it good enough. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about the search traces that Google collects about individuals. What happens if I want to learn about something bad or something I'm afraid of,
mm-hmm.
or about some threats I read about or some bad person or gambling, and Google will accumulate that? And surely you know about that incident a few years ago where AOL published search traces supposedly anonymously, and some woman in Connecticut was saying it right down to her social security number. And given the WikiLeaks debacle, which is currently the right thing of politics in the Middle East, because in Tunisia, the preservation of security of these traces is an ephemeron, which is going to go away the first time some critical need says you have to release that, or some Julian says, hey, I'm publishing this.
A couple of things to remember about this very case. Now, everything we do in the electronic environment is traceable by somebody, and Google may actually be low on the list of potential problems here. And I say that because, first of all, Google has done what it could do under our laws to keep federal investigators away from phishing expeditions in their data. Unfortunately, for us and for Google, our laws are on the side of the government. Right, so that's
a- well, I think if you listen to all that, kind of an interesting presentation, and as the first comment said, I think this gentleman is certainly up on the topic, and looks like that might be an interesting book to read. I think our timing is about right. We got his whole presentation in there. We look forward to seeing you next week, so we'll ask Vera Lynn to sign us off, as she usually does. We'll meet again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again someday.